Good? Good. Okay, so I wanted to start by thanking the organizers for the kind invitation. It's great to be here. I can report that your bike paths are still great for skateboarding, so you're doing a great job. Anyway, so what I'm gonna tell you about today is ongoing work in my group to make materials out of light, and the focus is going to be on topological materials, given the emphasis of the conference. So I thought I'd take a moment at the start just to talk about these the analogies that we're gonna be using in talking about synthetic materials here. So of course, what we're all most familiar with is materials composed of electrons hopping around in a lattice composed of ions. And basically, the idea is that the single particle physics of these electrons is more or less determined by the interaction with this ionic lattice, and much of the richness comes from the interactions between the electrons. So where I come from is building analogs of this using cold atoms hopping around in lattices of laser beams, and these laser beams not only induce a band structure, they can induce single particle topology and so forth, and then the atoms can, in principle, collide with one another and become entangled to give us interesting many-body physics. What I'm gonna tell you about today is a sort of new analog, which we're building up in my group using some very modern technological developments. The basic idea is that our particles that can hop around in the lattice are going to be photons. So the lattices, or the continua that they live in, will either be metamaterials composed of superconducting circuits, or in this case, an array, excuse me, four mirrors in a twisted configuration to give us a Landau level that lives on a cone. And the thing that, to me, has sort of stimulated these ideas is that it's now possible to either add Rydberg-dressed atoms to such a resonator or transmon qubits to each site in such a superconducting lattice and really mediate photon-photon interactions and go into a strongly interacting regime. So while the focus of the talk is gonna be on inducing single particle topological properties for these photons, I think there's a very bright future in adding interactions. So, again, time permitting, the two themes of the talk will be first, taking optical photons and trapping them in a non-planar optical resonator, which will essentially produce a Floquet kind of a system where we see bulk Landau levels for the photons. And it will turn out that these photons actually live in Landau levels on a conical manifold rather than in flat space. And then, time permitting, at the end, I'll talk a little bit about building Z2 and Schrn insulators, or I guess Schrn band structures, for RF and microwave photons, and our ideas for engineering chemical potentials to build many-body states there. Okay, so I should mention that this idea of photonic materials is not, strictly speaking, new. Our work is sort of, I would say, a hybridization of these three ideas. The first is to condense photons in a multimode optical resonator where the thermalization between the photons comes from a dye. So this is work from Martin Weitz's group. And these photons basically don't interact with each other at all, okay? What I think is another sort of closely related and fascinating system is this idea of getting your photon dynamics, again, from a cavity, but mediating interactions between the photons via hybridization to excitons. And this is basically mean field physics. And very recently, the groups of Vladan Vuletic and Misha Lukin at Harvard and MIT demonstrated that one can essentially produce a strongly interacting 1D gas of photons by hybridizing the light with Rydberg atoms. And so the dream here is sort of to engineer the single particle dynamics using a cavity, and then hybridize with these Rydberg atoms to potentially go into crystalline and fractional Hall phases. Okay, so the question is, really, in what sense does an optical resonator allow us to manipulate the single particle dispersion, trapping, so forth, of a photon? So the analogy that we're going to work on today is this idea that photons in a multimode optical resonator behave like massive particles in a harmonic trap. Okay, I want to be clear that this is a real space analogy, not the Fock space analogy that you were taught when you learned second quantization. Okay, so the statement is that this axis for this harmonic trap is going to be real space, and I'm talking about one photon which is either in the lowest level of the harmonic trap or the first excited state, second, third, fourth, fifth excited state of the harmonic trap. This is not an axis which describes the number of particles in the trap. Okay, so let's be a little more clear. Imagine I shine light in, I've got this two-mirror cavity, I'm going to shine light in off-axis in this cavity. So my claim is that I create this off-center wave packet, and it will oscillate back and forth in this transverse plane of the cavity. You can see this very simply just by sort of ray tracing. And you'll notice that I'm sort of coarse graining over the longitudinal dynamics. I'm just making a Poincaré section of where the photon hits in the central plane. So you can already see that this is going to be a Floquet kind of a story as we go forward. Okay. So for those of you who have taken any kind of quantum mechanics, which I guess is everybody, you know that the eigenstates of a quantum harmonic oscillator are uniformly spaced in energy, and they're Hermite-Gauss wave functions. On the other hand, for those of you who have ever operated a laser, which I'm guessing is no one, we've got one. A typical helium neon laser can lase on many different transverse modes that are uniformly spaced in energy, and they're Hermite-Gauss, right? So you can see that already for a fixed longitudinal quantum number in our cavity, there's a very nice analogy between a harmonic oscillator and a particle in a harmonic trap. Okay, so let's really beat this analogy to death. Imagine I inject a photon slightly off-center to the right of my resonator axis. I can write that photon state as a superposition of the lowest eigenstate of my resonator and the first excited state. But this first excited transverse mode evolves at a different frequency from the ground state, and eventually this plus sign turns into a minus sign, and the photon is now to the left of my resonator axis. Okay, so depending on where you're from, in Russia you learned about this in middle school, in the States it's maybe college, so this should be very familiar. So the picture then, remember I said we're coarse graining along the resonator axis. So these are our two mirrors. The photon is in a particular longitudinal mode of the cavity and is oscillating back and forth harmonically in the transverse plane. Okay, and we can compute a mass here basically from the size of the lowest mode of the cavity, and it ends up being some fraction of an electron mass. Okay, now I thought, given this audience, it might be nice to take a brief moment to really develop kind of a Floquet picture of what's going on here. So I have a two-mirror cavity, and I have some field right after this first mirror of the cavity. Okay, I want to know what field I have once the light has propagated to the other end of the cavity. So the picture is basically that the field at the far end of the cavity here is equal to the field that at the input end times e to the I kz l. But remember that kz is actually an operator. Okay, so this is really about e to the I k minus kx squared over 2k l. Okay, where kx squared is basically p squared. Right? And so basically what we've said is that propagation along the cavity axis from one end of the cavity to the other is more or less like time evolution of a free particle. Okay? So let's look at this carefully. So I propagate from one end of the cavity to the other. I get free particle evolution. When I reflect off of this mirror, I get a phase which is quadratic in my transverse location. It's a spherical mirror, right? Then when I propagate back, I get another free evolution, and then some more evolution under a harmonic trap. So I can compute a Floquet Hamiltonian from this. And with a little bit of Baker-Campbell-Hausdorff work, this turns out really just to be a massive particle with the mass coming from the free space propagation and the trapping coming from the curvature of the mirrors. Okay? So, wow, that slide did not do quite what I wanted, but all right. So the question is there a simple way to add a magnetic field to this picture, right? We've added all other quadratic terms. We've got a mass and we've got trapping, but can we create the cross terms that we want? And the answer is that resonator twist is going to allow us to do that. And so the term that we're going to need to add to get a magnetic field is e to the I theta LZ, okay? It's going to give us some rotation per round trip. But of course, you can't twist a two-mirror cavity. And so the game is to now go to a four-mirror configuration and twist it out of the plane. Okay? This gives us a rotation per round trip. And to understand that, what you need to do is think back to the last U-boat movie that you watched. Okay? So when you watch a World War II submarine movie, they've got their periscope, right? And when the captain wants to look that way, he goes like this. Did you ever wonder why there isn't just a crank? No? Nobody ever wondered that? I wondered that. I asked this at the CUA, and Bert Halperin immediately had the answer, which was disappointing. So this is a better response than that. I'll just show you. A periscope is two mirrors like this, okay? So imagine this is my image. It reflects off the mirror, comes down, and comes out. No problem, right? What came in is what came out. Imagine that the two mirrors are 90 degrees rotated. My image got rotated by 90 degrees. Okay? And so the answer is it's already fairly unpleasant to be in a submarine, right? And you're turning this crank and the image is turning upside down, that would be very, very difficult to stomach. So the basic point is twisting this cavity essentially gives you a non-trivial Christoffel connection at each mirror, right? And when you follow this all the way around the path, you've got some round-trip rotation of your actual image, okay? So what I'm showing here is a sort of trivial thing. These are rays that run parallel to the axis of the cavity, okay? And so for a planar cavity, you have to come back to where you started after a round trip if you're parallel to the cavity axis. But for this weird non-planar geometry, you come back with a little rotation. And so basically, the way to think about this is that twisting the resonator out of the plane makes the lab frame into a rotating frame. Okay? And so what that does is it introduces both a Coriolis force, right, which is the same as a Lorentz force, incidentally, and a harmonic anti-confining force. And so the game to get a Landau level is to adjust your mirror curvature to precisely cancel that anti-confining force, right? And then all you're left with is a Coriolis force, which is the same as a Lorentz force, and that's going to give us our Landau level. Okay? Let's draw out what we're talking about here. So again, I'm going to draw just one Floquet copy. Remember, there are an infinite number of copies of this corresponding to the different longitudinal quantum numbers of this cavity. Okay? And this is just a particle in a harmonic trap, 2D harmonic trap. And as I twist this out of the plane, what you're going to see is that these, of course, can no longer be the eigenstates of the cavity, right? Because you get some rotation per round trip, and so the eigenstate will be this plus or minus I times that, right? And more generally, the eigenstates will be Z to the L, e to the minus magnitude z squared for the states along this diagonal, But the interesting thing is that these states are all going to move down in energy because they'll oscillate with the field, or excuse me, with the rotation, and these ones will all move up in energy. So let's watch that happen. And so what you can see is as you rotate, you eventually make all of these states almost degenerate. Okay? And this is the lowest Landau level. Now, there's one problem. Anyone who's ever seen a cold atom person try to do this knows that when you try to rotate right at your trapping frequency, any astigmatism in your trap basically destabilizes the gas. And you can even see in this simulation that these modes are getting destabilized. Right. So for those who aren't familiar with this picture, the basic statement is imagine you have a slightly elliptical harmonic trap, and you start to rotate it. And you want to rotate at just the right frequency so that you compensate for the harmonic confinement. Well, you'll compensate one axis, but overcompensate the other. Right. And so you'll end up with this kind of saddle potential, and all of your states end up being edge states that get directed off to infinity. So that's real bad. The cavity doesn't work. But the key point is that this sort of astigmatism really only drives delta L equals 2 transitions. Okay? And so we tried to do this, and it didn't work, perhaps unsurprisingly. But we need to make a cavity now where you can't drive delta L equals 2 transitions. Okay? And so then the game is, can we make some kind of a cavity that where the manifold of degenerate states is just L equals 0, 3, 6, 9, 12, 15, so forth. Okay? So the answer is yes, we can do that because we've got this bizarre flow K system. So what I'm plotting here is many different lowest Landau levels, okay, for different longitudinal quantum numbers. So this is just the different flow K copies. Okay? And typically in a flow K kind of a system, we think of these as being the same thing. Right? But for us, they're actually not the same. They have different numbers of basically wavelengths going around our resonator. Okay? And so what we're going to do is just keep twisting the cavity, okay, until the L equals 3 state from this manifold goes down and becomes degenerate with the L equals 0 from the next one. And L equals 6 from this guy becomes degenerate. So this gives us our manifold of states, L equals 0, 3, 6, 9, 12, 15, 18. And we expect it to be stable. But the question is, what is it? So we spent some time chatting with Paul Wigman and Sohn. And then we did a little numerics. And what you discover is ray tracing here. You don't get one cyclotron orbit, but you get three. You start on this one, and then on a round trip, you appear on the second one. On the next round trip, you appear on the third one, and then go back to where you started. So what is going on? Well, of course, we see that there's going to have to be a threefold symmetry. What I'd like to convince you of is that this sort of dynamics corresponds to living on the surface of a cone. Okay? So. Okay, great. Why do I say a cone? Well, dynamics everywhere on a cone corresponds to, behaves like flat space. I can make my cone out of a sheet of paper everywhere but right at this cone tip where there's a bunch of Gaussian curvature. So imagine I have a cone that I can unwrap into a third of the plane, okay? And then I identify these two edges so that when I leave one, I come back in on the other one, okay? So one can, in principle, be more formal about this. But I'll hopefully just be able to convince you with our data. We make a little structure. It's about this big. We 3D print it. We stuff high finesse mirrors into it and tune it to degeneracy. Come on. And we see bizarre threefold symmetric things that look like this. So let's be a little more formal about that. We can basically tune this system to degeneracy and generate a spectroscopic probe using a deformable micromirror array that allows us to measure the energy with sort of kilohertz resolution and the spatial modes in real space. And so what you can see is that as we tune this resonator length, the L equals 0, 3, 6, and 9 modes become more or less degenerate. And we can zoom in on that point. and look at these different modes and see them really come into degeneracy as we tune the length of this cavity over, you know, ultimately we have to be accurate to about a micron out of 5 centimeters. And the resonator is actually stable. You can look at these modes as you approach this degeneracy point. And what you see is you have this little tail that goes out and comes back in when we're right on degeneracy. We think that's because there's about an angstrom deep scratch in the mirror surface, basically creating an edge state that goes out and comes back in. Essentially, the cavity doesn't just explode. You know, you can still see some reasonable finesse. The light goes around. Everything works great. Okay, so let's convince ourselves that this is really a lambda level. So I can, of course, inject light right in the center. And what I'm doing here is taking taking a third of this plane and wrapping it onto this cone, just so that you can see what it looks like. I should be able to translate away from the cone tip and inject in light there. And sure enough, when I do that, I get these three copies of this lowest mode. And in fact, if this is really a lowest Landau level, it should support these z to the l, e to the minus zz bar states translated away from the cone tip. So we can increase the angular momentum of the state that we inject, and everything seems very clean. Until you inject states with so much angular momentum that they start self-intersecting. And then you get crazy stuff like this. So the first time we saw this, we said, this must mean that this model breaks down, okay, when the mode self-intersects, okay? What I'd like to argue is that that's not the case. What you're really starting to see is Wen-Z physics. So what do I mean by that? Let's take a look here. These are modes that we injected that actually encircle this cone tip. And when you look at it by eye, you kind of say, well, this goes around the cone tip once. But let's be careful. If I unwrap a third of the plane into the whole plane, what you can see is that this actually enters all three copies of the cone. So in fact, it goes around the cone tip three times. Okay? And if we just take a cyclotron orbit, a flat space cyclotron orbit, and translate it up towards the cone tip, what you can see is that it actually orbits the cone tip three times, right up until this weird point where it looks very degenerate, right? The orbit actually got smaller there than it was away from the cone tip. And this should be a big hint that we're seeing Wen-Z physics. So the story is basically this. If I take this plane and I take a third of it and wrap it on itself, each one of these sort of little cyclotron orbits you can think of as corresponding to one particle's worth of density of states, okay? This smaller orbit still has to correspond to one particle, right? And so what that means is that we have enhanced density of states at the cone tip, okay? So the game in practice now is to split out the modes a little bit by adding a little bit of harmonic trapping back, spectroscopically resolve each of the modes, again using our sort of optical STM kind of technique, and then add them back up to get a density of states. What we see is that on this cone with L equals 0.369, we have an enhanced density of states at the cone tip. Of course, there's another cone which starts with L equals 1.47. That one has a little divot at the tip. And then there's another one that starts at 2.5811, which has an even bigger divot at the tip. Collaboration with Andrei Gromov, we basically discovered that you can extract the mean orbital spin from the excess area here, the mean orbital spin of this integer quantum Hall state. So what we see is that we essentially have a third of a state, more or less exactly what you'd predict from a simple theory, for this L equals zero cone. But then this cone that starts at L equals one actually has no excess density, which means that there's actually some flux threaded through the tip here. And this guy is actually missing density, which means there's basically two-thirds of a flux threaded through that cone tip. Okay, so then the next logical step, of course, moving forward is going to be to add interactions to this story. So essentially what we're working on in the lab, and I don't want to talk too much about this. I'd rather talk about building the states, but is adding a Rydberg-dressed atomic ensemble in a particular plane here. Basically, you have to pick one plane of your Floquet system, because you can either say you get diffraction in between, or you can say that the Floquet micromotion is actually gigantic in this system, because we're hopping from one copy to the next, and back to where we started. And so you need to be very careful to have your sample be thin. And so we've got these systems in vacuum. We're seeing vacuum Rabi splittings and Rydberg electromagnetically induced transparency. We're using the atoms to actually break time reversal between forwards and backwards modes. But then one might reasonably ask, okay, so you've built this Hamiltonian, but photon number isn't conserved, and you essentially have no way to thermalize your photons. How do you build a Laughlin state in this kind of a system? So what I'd like to argue is that there are several sort of really neat ways that one can do this that are unique to photons, not even sort of applicable to cold atoms. So the basic game is, imagine I inject light into this L equals zero mode of a cavity where the photons are strongly interacting. Okay? Well, I can put one photon into this mode. Okay? But if I try to put a second one in, the strong repulsion between the photons sort of tunes the cavity mode away. So the second photon won't go into the cavity. And so, that makes one photon in L equals zero. Great. For those in the quantum optics community in the know, this kind of experiment was done without twisted cavities, without Rydbergs, by Jeff Kimball 11 years ago. Okay? The place where things get magical is if we inject into the L equals 1 mode of the cavity. Okay? I can put one photon in, and you might think that when I try to put a second one in, I would again get blockaded. Okay? But what you should remember is that essentially we have very short range interactions between our photons. Okay? And I can conserve angular momentum by taking my two L equals 1 photons and sending one to L equals 0 and one to L equals 2. Right? The collision is allowed to do that. So what I need to ask is there some state which is a superposition of two photons in L equals 1 and one in L equals 0 and one in L equals 2 which has no contact interaction energy? And I would guess that this audience will immediately recognize this as the bosonic-Laughlin state for two photons. Okay? And so the statement is, if I inject light, just a coherent laser beam, into the L equals 1 mode, what will leak out the other side of the cavity is a two-photon Laughlin state. Okay? And in fact, if I inject into the L equals 2 mode of the cavity, what will leak out is a three-photon Laughlin state, and L equals 4, and so on and so forth. So this works fairly well up to about L equals 3 or 4, but what you discover is that the sort of matrix elements overlaps for this to happen, get very small fairly quickly. But we do have what I think is a pretty awesome alternative way of doing this. Remember, I pointed out to you that we have three different cavities with different flux threaded through them, as we verified from this Wenzi excess density near the cone tip. So the game will be, use this blockade physics to inject a photon into L equals zero, and then thread two fluxes through the system by coupling the photons from one cone to the next, and so forth. And that's a single particle interaction. It doesn't require good many-body gaps at all to move the photons from one cone to the next. And when you do that twice, you've put two quasi-holes in the center of your cloud. Okay? And now when I try to inject another photon, basically what I'm doing is injecting into the root Jack polynomial of the two-photon Laughlin, bosonic Laughlin state. Okay? And the matrix overlap there, it turns out, is about 90%. And then I can flux thread again, and again it remains 90%. No matter how many particles I put in, because I'm injecting in the middle, you always get very good overlap. Thank you. So anyway, I think this is sort of a beautiful at least demonstration in my mind that there's some very interesting physics that we have access to with photons and sort of not in other systems. So I'll skip this and just mention that one thing we're playing with right now is using Kitaev's real space Chern number formalism to extract the Chern number of this lowest Landau level using essentially holographic reconstruction of the band projectors. We also, if anyone's interested, you can ask me about it now or later, have these topological circuits that either implement Z2 topological insulators by braiding connections between inductors and capacitors, or sort of quarter flux Hofstadter models that break T, implemented with superconducting resonator arrays in yttrium iron garnet crystals and some of the latticites with interactions mediated by transmons. And then we have a whole nother set of ideas, basically based on ideas from Jake Taylor and Mohammed Hafezi for implementing chemical potentials to populate these photonic metamaterials. So I guess with that, I can skip the next 20 slides. I have to show you this. So we have time-resolved dynamics of these edge states. Oh, I see, it's not clicked. There we go. And so we can actually excite this system and watch. This whole movie takes place in like a microsecond, but you can watch the photons propagate around and around the edge of the system in these chiral edge modes. This is Clay. He's actually happy, even though he looks sad. This is him connecting. He has time and spectroscopic resolution at every latticite in our system. So I'm supposed to stop talking right now. So with that, I will thank my group, which is here, and you guys for your attention.
So a disclaimer, I do have an optics table at home, and I do operate lasers.
At home?
Yeah.
For holograms?
I can bring it tomorrow.
So what is the prospect of realizing these quantum Hall states at optical frequency?
What do you think? The Laughlin states.
No, just as integer quantum Hall states.
So
you talk about microwaves, but what about
so the set of data that I showed you was actually optical.
I see, okay.
But in some sense, I think a lot of people would object to calling that an integer quantum Hall. What I would say is it's a band structure or a metamaterial whose eigenstates correspond to a Landau level, right? But because the particles are bosons, there's no Fermi surface. So you can't really talk about integer quantum Hall or sigma xy, right? But you can talk about the Chern number of the bands, right? And in the interacting case, you can look for Laughlin-type physics and anions and so forth. So that's what we're really gunning for now.
There's a very beautiful work. So basically, you are using the orbital angular momentum of light. Light also have polarization and spin. So can you also use the polarization degree of freedom to do more things?
So I swept something very important under the rug, which is the cavity structure that I showed you. It's a four-mirror structure. It's chiral, but it doesn't break time reversal symmetry, right? Because it's just a mechanical structure. How can it possibly break time reversal symmetry? So how am I seeing Landau levels, right, without breaking time reversal symmetry? Well, in some sense, the system is sort of a spin Hall system, okay? Where the spin degree of freedom, though, is not polarization. The spin degree of freedom is, if these are the four mirrors, do I propagate this way or that way? Now, the interesting point is, the polarization degree of freedom The modes of this cavity have to be circularly polarized, right? Because the polarization gets rotated a little bit on each round trip, just as the image gets rotated a little bit. And so what this means is that there are two different lowest Landau levels, one that's right circularly polarized and one that's left circularly polarized. Okay, that's just for the light that's going this way. And then there are also two for the light that's going the other way. But here's the interesting thing. The time reversal symmetric pair, right, is one that goes this way that's right helicity, and one that goes this way that's right helicity, right? But relative to a fixed axis, those have opposite circular polarization. So what we're using ultimately to break time reversal symmetry is just an atomic Faraday effect, right? So you ask about polarization, and the answer is, you know, the atoms don't have to do anything spatially to break time reversal symmetry, but they do have to separate those two Landau levels. Otherwise, when we add interactions, there will be terrible backscattering when they scatter off each other.
So speaking of interactions, would you care to just comment a little bit more about the progress towards turning those interactions on?
Yes, I would love to. Thank you, Jake. So that's what we call a softball question, and I appreciate it. So the basic challenge in generating these interactions between the photons, you know, photons interact at, what is it, fourth or sixth order in the fine structure constant, which is zero for all intents and purposes. So our interactions are more or less like interactions between photons mediated by excitons, but excitons only interact weakly. Right? And so our interactions essentially come from, as the photons propagate through the atomic cloud, they will excite the atoms up to a Rydberg state, n equals 100, right? Where the electron orbit is several microns. Okay, and so you get what are called Rydberg polaritons instead of exciton polaritons. So this renormalizes the effective mass of the photon and so forth. And we've basically seen the single particle physics just fine. The challenge is, you really want strong interactions between your photons, right? So you need to go up to n equals 100, the interaction scale like n to the 11th, but the DC polarizability scales like n to the 6th. And so what this means is we are exploring surface physics at distances of millimeters. you know, it's really terrible. And so the game basically is that for the last generation of cavities, we ran into that, and it's a big problem. The new generation, I can show you the picture later, the atoms are now centimeters away from the mirrors. The cavity is in vacuum. I was hoping to have data to show you guys today. The students are pushing as hard as they can, but I think it's solved at this point. There's one there. I see. Anyone but him.
Well, yeah, anyway, so about your quantum spin hole insulator. So basically, so explain a little bit that now your helicity is actually the plays a role as the spin in the ordinary quantum spin hole insulator, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the key of that Z2 spin, the key of that Z2 top-level insulator is that for Fermion system, T squared equals to minus one for a single Fermion state. But here you have a spin one for the photon. So T squared should be one instead of minus one. So is that going to be an issue?
So I think, let me see if I can rephrase that a little bit. As an experimentalist, the challenge is T squared equals minus one means that unless you have an impurity, which breaks time reversal symmetry?
Yes,
exactly. You don't get backscattering.
Right.
Right? And here, basically, it's much easier to have effectively magnetic impurities.
Okay.
And that's absolutely true. So in the circuit, what we ended up doing to break time to avoid that, is having the students very carefully measure the values of inductors. Mm-hmm. Right? We buy 10 times more than we need. so that's like 10,000. And then when they solder the circuit together, they make sure that they're very well matched. such that the time to backscatter is longer than the amount of time before the photons are lost just due to the dissipation in the system, right? So that's for the Z2. But you're absolutely right. The basic point is what you really want to do is break time reversal. And so the Yig spheres do that for the circuits, and the Faraday rotation does it in the other case.
What is the Poynting number? Is it Poynting number equals to photon number, or do you have some kind of tricks how you count this?
So you mean for the data I showed you, or
in particular for the interaction data, what did you want?
So that will be each particle is one photon, right?
But what you showed now is not a single photon.
So what I showed now is single times 10 to the 12 photons, something like that. But in some sense, the story is what I showed you today is essentially a very, very low loss metamaterial, right? Normally, these metamaterials aren't compatible with strong interactions, right? This one is, but if the system's linear, you may as well use a ridiculous number of photons because it's just easier, right?
And how do you get to a low photon?
Oh, that's very easy. We pay big bucks to have lasers with high photon numbers. And then what you do is you stick your finger in the beam and block most of them. Or rub your finger on a lens. And exactly. Yes. You want to come to lab, Duncan? We could use somebody like you.